Paul receives bad advice. This chapter is based on Acts 21, verse 17 to 23, 35. Paul gave the leaders at Jerusalem the contributions the Gentile churches had sent for the support of the poor among the Jewish believers. The amount far exceeded what the elders at Jerusalem had expected. It represented severe sacrifice and self-denial on the part of the Gentile believers. These freewill offerings showed the Gentile converts' loyalty to the organized work of God throughout the world. Yet some were clearly unable to appreciate the spirit of brotherly love that had prompted the gifts. In earlier years, some of the leaders at Jerusalem had not cooperated cheerfully with Paul. In their concern to preserve a few meaningless forms and ceremonies, they had lost sight of the blessing that would come through trying to unite all parts of the Lord's work into one. They had failed to keep up with God's leading forward and tried to put many unnecessary restrictions on the workers. Men who did not know the particular needs in distant fields insisted that they had the authority to direct the workers there to follow certain specific ways of working. Several years had gone by since the Jerusalem leadership had carefully considered the methods used by those working among the Gentiles and had made recommendations about certain rites and ceremonies. At this general council, the leaders had also united in recommending Barnabas and Paul as missionaries, worthy of every believer's full confidence. At this meeting, some had severely criticized the apostles who were carrying the gospel to the Gentile world. But during the council, their views of God's plans had broadened, and they united in making decisions that made it possible to unite the entire body of believers. Some leaders continued to hurt Paul's ministry. Afterward, when converts among the Gentiles were increasing rapidly, a few leaders at Jerusalem began to revive their former prejudices against Paul's methods. Some of the leaders determined that from then on, the work must be conducted according to their own ideas. If Paul would conform to their policies, they would recognize and support his work. Otherwise, they could no longer support it. These men had lost sight of the fact that God is the teacher of his people. Every worker in his cause is to follow the divine leader, not looking to others for direct guidance. God's workers are to be molded in the divine likeness. Paul had taught the people not with persuasive words of human wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. 1 Corinthians 2, verse 4. He had looked to God for direct guidance, yet he had been careful to work in harmony with the decisions of the General Council at Jerusalem. As a result, the churches were strengthened in the faith and increased in number daily. Acts 16, verse 5. Despite the lack of sympathy that some showed him, he had encouraged a spirit of loyalty, generosity, and brotherly love in his converts, as the liberal contributions he placed before the Jewish elders showed. Paul told in detail those things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. This brought the conviction, even to those who had been doubting, that God had blessed his work. When they heard it, they glorified the Lord. The methods the apostle followed bore the approval of heaven. The leaders who had urged arbitrary control saw Paul's ministry in a new light and were convinced that they had been wrong. Jewish customs and traditions had held them in bondage, and they had obstructed the work of the gospel by not recognizing that the death of Christ had broken down the dividing wall between Jew and Gentile. This was the golden opportunity for all the leadership to freely admit that God had worked through Paul, and that sometimes they had been wrong to allow his enemies to stir up their jealousy and prejudice. But instead of doing what was right to the one who had been injured, they showed that they still wanted to hold Paul largely responsible for the existing prejudice. They did not stand nobly in his defense, but tried to strike a compromise. Advice to compromise leads to disaster.
"You see, brother," they said in response to his testimony, "how many thousands of believers there are among the Jews, and they are all zealous for the law. They have been told about you that you teach all the Jews living among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, and that you tell them not to circumcise their children or observe the customs. So do what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Join these men, go through the rite of purification with them, and pay for the shaving of their heads. Thus all will know that there is nothing in what they have been told about you, but that you yourself observe and guard the law. But as for the Gentiles who have become believers, we have sent a letter with our judgment that they should abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what is strangled, and from fornication. These men assured Paul that the former council's decision about Gentile converts and the ceremonial law was still good. But the advice they now gave was not consistent with that decision. The Spirit of God did not prompt this instruction. It was the fruit of cowardice. Many of the Jews who had accepted the gospel still cherished the ceremonial law. They were only too willing to make unwise concessions in the hope of removing prejudice and winning their countrymen to faith in Christ as the world's Redeemer. Paul realized that as long as many leading members of the church at Jerusalem continued to hold prejudice against him, they would constantly work against his influence. He felt that if he could win them to the truth by a reasonable concession, he would remove a great obstacle to the success of the gospel in other places. But God did not authorize him to go as far as they asked. When we think of Paul's great desire to be in harmony with other believers, his tenderness toward those who were weak in faith, and his deep respect for the apostles who had been with Christ, it is less surprising that he felt it necessary to depart from the firm course he had followed up to then. But his efforts to satisfy others' concerns only brought on his predicted sufferings more quickly, separated him from the other believers, and deprived the church of one of its strongest pillars. The next day, Paul began to follow the counsel of the elders. He took the four men under the Nazarite vow, number 6, into the temple. Those who advised Paul to do this had not considered how it would put him in great danger. He had visited many of the world's largest cities and was well known to thousands who had come to Jerusalem to attend the feast. Among these were men who hated Paul bitterly. He would risk his life to enter the temple on a public occasion. For several days he was apparently unnoticed, but as he was talking with a priest about the sacrifices to be offered, some Jews from Asia recognized him. With the fury of demons, they rushed at him. "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against the people, the law, and this place." And as the people responded to the call for help, another accusation was added. "Furthermore, he also brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." By Jewish law, for an uncircumcised person to enter the inner courts of the sacred temple was a crime punishable by death. Paul had been seen in the city with Trophimus, an Ephesian, and people concluded that he had brought him into the temple. He had not done so, and since he was a Jew himself, his own act of entering the temple was no violation of the law. The hatred shown to Christ repeated against Paul. But although the charge was completely false, it served to stir up popular prejudice. Wild excitement spread through Jerusalem. All the city was disturbed, and the people ran together, seized Paul, and dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. Now, as they were seeking to kill him, news came to the commander of the garrison that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. Claudius Lysias immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Seeing that the crowd's rage was directed at Paul, the Roman captain took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains, and he asked who he was and what he had done. Immediately, many voices rose in loud and angry accusation. So when he could not ascertain the truth because of the tumult, he commanded him to be taken into the barracks. For the multitude of the people followed after, crying out, "Away with him!" Paul was calm and self-possessed. He knew that angels of heaven were around him. As he was about to be led into the barracks, he said to the chief captain, "May I speak to you?" Lysias responded, "Are you not the Egyptian who stirred up a rebellion and led the 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness?"
In reply, Paul said, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city, and I implore you, permit me to speak to the people." The unreasoning hatred of Paul's enemies. Lysias agreed, and Paul stood on the stairs and motioned with his hand to the people. His bearing invited respect. And when there was a great silence, he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, saying, "Brethren and fathers, hear my defense before you now." In the universal hush, he continued, "I am indeed a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, taught according to the strictness our father's law, and was zealous toward God as you all are today." The facts he referred to were well known. He then spoke of his previous zeal in persecuting the disciples of Christ, and he told the story of his conversion, how his proud heart had come to bow to the crucified Nazarene. His account of his experience seemed to soften and subdue the hearts of his opponents. He then showed that he had wanted to work for his own nation, but in that very temple the voice of God had spoken to him, directing him to go far from here, to the Gentiles. The rage of exclusivism. The people were listening with close attention, but when Paul reached the point where he was appointed ambassador to the Gentiles, their fury broke out again. They were unwilling to let the despised Gentiles share the privileges they had thought of as exclusively their own. They shouted, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live." Then, as they cried out, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging, that he might know why they shouted so against him. And as they bound him with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who stood by, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?" When the centurion heard that, he went and told the commander, saying, "Take care what you do, for this man is a Roman." Then the commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" He said, "Yes." The commander answered, "With a large sum I obtained this citizenship." And Paul said, "But I was born a citizen." Then immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him, and the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman, and because he had bound him. The next day, because he wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds, and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear, and brought Paul down and set him before them. Acts 22, verse 25 to 30. Paul before the court of law. As he stood before the Jewish rulers, Paul's face revealed the peace of Christ. "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. At this inhuman command, Paul exclaimed, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. For you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law?" And those who stood by said, "Do you revile God's high priest?" With his usual courtesy, Paul answered, "I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged." The two parties began to argue between themselves, and this broke the strength of their opposition to Paul. The scribes of the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, "We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him,
Let us not fight against God. The Sadducees were eagerly trying to take custody of the apostle so that they could kill him, and the Pharisees were as eager to protect him. The commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the barracks. Later, Paul began to fear that his actions might not have been pleasing to God. Had he made a mistake in visiting Jerusalem? Had his great desire to be in union with his fellow believers led to this terrible result? How would those heathen officers think of the Jews as God's professed people, taking a sacred office, yet giving themselves up to blind anger, trying to destroy even their fellow countrymen who dared to differ with them in religious faith, and turning their solemn council into a scene of wild confusion? The name of God had suffered disgrace in the eyes of the heathen.
And now he knew that his enemies would stop at nothing to kill him. Could it be that his work for the churches was over, and that vicious wolves were to enter in now? He thought of the dangers facing the scattered churches, exposed to the persecutions of people like he had encountered in the Sanhedrin Council. In distress, he wept and prayed. In this dark hour, the Lord revealed himself to his faithful witness in response to his earnest prayers for guidance. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness in Rome." While the Lord encouraged his servant, Paul's enemies were plotting to destroy him. Conspirators came to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a great oath that we will eat nothing until we have killed Paul. Now you, therefore, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow, as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him. But we are ready to kill him before he comes near." The priests and rulers eagerly agreed. Paul had spoken the truth when he compared Ananias to a whitewashed wall. Paul's nephew foils the plot. But God stepped in to save his servant. Paul's sister's son heard about the assassin's ambush, and he entered the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, "Take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the commander and said, "Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you." Claudius Lysias received the youth kindly. "What is it that you have to tell me?" The youth replied, "The Jews have agreed to ask that you bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire more fully about him. But do not yield to them, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for the promise from you." So the commander let the young man depart and commanded him, "Tell no one that you have revealed these things to me." Lysias called for 2 centurions, saying, "Prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the 3rd hour of the night, and provide mounts to set Paul on, and bring him safely to Felix the governor." Acts 23, verse 20 to 24. They were to lose no time. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him during the night to Antipatris. The horsemen went on with the prisoner to Caesarea. The officer in charge delivered his prisoner to Felix, also presenting a letter. "Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix. Greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you, and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him." Adding crime to crime. In their rage against Paul, the Jews had added another crime to the dark record that marked their history,
and had made their doom more certain. In the synagogue at Nazareth, Christ reminded his hearers that in the past, God had turned away from his chosen people because of their unbelief and rebellion, and had revealed himself to people in heathen lands who had not rejected the light of heaven. The faithful messenger of God would find no safety with backsliding Israel. The Jewish leaders were taking the people farther and farther from obedience to God, where he could not defend them in the day of trouble. The Savior's words of rebuke to the people of Nazareth applied in Paul's case, of Paul to his own brethren in the Christian faith. If the leaders in the church had fully surrendered their bitterness toward the apostle and accepted him as one God had specially called to carry the gospel to the Gentiles, the Lord would have preserved him for them. God had not decreed that Paul's work should end so soon. The same Spirit is still depriving the church of many blessings. How often would the Lord have prolonged the work of some faithful minister if the church had appreciated his efforts? But if church members misrepresent and misinterpret the words and acts of Christ's servant, allowing themselves to stand in his way, the Lord sometimes removes the blessing he had given them.
Those God has chosen to accomplish a great and good work may be ready to sacrifice even life itself for the cause of Christ. Yet the great deceiver will suggest doubts about them to their fellow believers to undermine confidence in their integrity and cripple their usefulness. Too often, through their own fellow Christians, Satan succeeds in bringing upon them such sorrow of heart that God graciously intervenes to give his persecuted servants rest. After the voice of warning and encouragement goes silent, then these hardened opposers may see and value the blessings they have thrown away. The death of God's servants may accomplish what their life failed to do.